It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. How is it that a 400-year-old play, said to be ripped from the headlines of its times, still resonates with the modern day? Perhaps because life imitates art and art imitates life, the work of William Shakespeare continues to compel people well into the 21st century. The headlines, if there actually had been headlines in the early 1600s, included an urban terrorist plot that shocked a nation, increased national security and surveillance by the government, all in an era of national unease and political division. Preeminent Shakespeare scholar James Shapiro examines one of the bard's most productive periods in his book The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. He argues that an age of post-Elizabethan anxiety led to Shakespeare's darkest work. In short, Shakespeare in an age of terror. James Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
What do we know about Shakespeare's personal life in 1606?
Less than anyone would want to. Shakespeare kept a very low profile in general, and I would say as low a profile as any year in his professional career in 1606, which makes it hard to discover him in that year. And the only way really we can find him is in the reflected glare of contemporary events that affected his family and the London he lived in.
Well, this was a huge time of change in that London he lived in. And for England, Shakespeare had made his name in the Elizabethan era. And at the time you're writing about, that era had ended. So how did regime change affect Shakespeare's life and how he would be working?
We love to speak of Shakespeare as an Elizabethan. At the end of that great movie, Shakespeare in Love, Queen Elizabeth comes down and solves the problem and engages Shakespeare. We would never think to imagine that he was also a playwright for much of his career, for the most spectacular years of his career, under King James. And not only that, but when King James followed Queen Elizabeth to the English throne in 1603, the first thing he did after arriving from Scotland, one of the very first things he did, was make Shakespeare and his fellow players the king's men, the royal company. So this was a sea change for Shakespeare, both for better and for worse. And as a playwright who had understood perfectly, really, as well as anyone could, the shifting plate tectonics of Elizabethan culture, Shakespeare now had to adjust and find his footing in the new regime under King James. And that proved more difficult, I think, than he might have expected.
Well, it would seem, as far as patronage goes, that the reign of King James was good for Shakespeare. However, it was not so good for a number of other people, and they weren't too happy about what King James had in mind. Tell us about the gunpowder plot.
Before King James succeeded Elizabeth, he had made a lot of promises that he couldn't quite keep. Among the promises he had made was that he would be far more tolerant of Catholics in England when he came down from Scotland to rule there. And his mother was Mary, Queen of Scots, Catholic. His wife, Anne, was a practicing Catholic, and expectations were high that James would tolerate Catholics. The Catholics in England were disappointed, and two or three years into his reign, decided to take matters into their own hands. A group of 20 or so really disaffected young Catholic gentry plotted together to plant 36 barrels of gunpowder under the House of Lords when King James, the royal family, the political and religious elite of England were gathered there on November 5th. And they were going to blow it sky high, perhaps kill 30,000 Londoners, and then try to provoke a Catholic uprising that would roll back the English information and restore Catholicism to the land. And this was really the first great terrorist threat, and they were thwarted at the last minute. We still celebrate or know of Guy Fawkes Day every November 5th, and it was traumatic for England. It turned out to be a very good grist for the mill of England's dramatists, but it was something that shook this culture to the core.
What's interesting is that Shakespeare may have actually known some of these would-be terrorists.
Well, one of the surprising things for me, I've been teaching and studying Shakespeare for 30 years, was that Shakespeare was known and knew people on both sides of this. His fellow playwright, Ben Jonson, was actually caught dining with gunpowder plotters in the weeks before the attack. Shakespeare's next-door neighbor, George Badger, was the bagman for Catholic relics when the uprising spread briefly to Shakespeare country in the wake of the failed attack. He was related, distantly related through his Arden line to a number of those who planned and hoped to carry out the plot. So he must have felt deeply, deeply implicated and connected to both sides, those chasing the perpetrators and those who had thought to carry out this terrorist attack. And in our post 9/11 days, I think we can be especially conscious of what this might have meant for Shakespeare.
Well, you mentioned the post 9/11 era and how a government responds to a terrorist attack. What were some of the things that King James ordered to try to stamp down and seek out these terrorists?
King James himself was pretty moderate. He did not want to crush the Catholics. He was just as suspicious of the right-wing Protestants, and he was a centrist ruler and a fairly tolerant one. However, those in Parliament, those who would have been blown sky high, took a different view. They were debating taking away children from Catholic families. They were debating not letting Catholics live within 10 miles or so of London. And one of the things they did enact was legislation requiring everybody to follow Protestant religious rites on Easter. Anybody who did not do so was subject to a fine of £20, basically what a teacher makes today. And remarkably, Shakespeare's eldest daughter, Susanna, refused to go with what the state and the religious authorities decreed. And the politics hit quite home for Shakespeare this year.
Some people are shocked when there is a particularly bloody or violent staging of a Shakespeare play. And Shakespeare's material can certainly support that. There's violent acts and violent language, and you know, some of it's kind of gory. I think some people might be shocked by the level of violence that existed in Shakespeare's time, especially in 1606.
Well, in the early months of 1606, the gunpowder plotters who had survived the short-lived uprising in Warwickshire were brought to London, tortured, stage trial. They were guilty from the start as far as the government was concerned. And then they were publicly executed, four one day and four the next. An Elizabethan execution was not simply being beheaded. If you were an aristocrat, you might be. But if you weren't, you had a grim fate awaiting you. You were dragged on a hurdle by horses to the place of execution, where they would hang you for a little bit, then cut you down before you had breathed your last, cut you open, rip out your organs, rip out your heart, and then butcher the rest of you. One of the gunpowder plotters, Sir Everard Digby, reportedly, as they cut him open and ripped out his heart while he was still alive, and the executioner raised his heart up to the crowd and said, "Here is the heart of a traitor," Digby, in his dying breath, reportedly said, "Thou liest." It was incredible theater, and it was as gruesome as you can imagine.
It's kind of not surprising to see that these plotters became martyrs as standing up against oppressive regime, and people still wear those Guy Fawkes masks and appropriate that iconography today.
Well, one person's terrorist is another person's martyr. And the challenge in 1606 was to decide what was the story of what happened on Gunpowder Play. Was this heroic? Was this despicable? Was this the work of the devil? How does a society wrestle with larger questions of evil, especially when they're tinged with religious and political questions? And that's just the stuff Shakespeare would take on in Macbeth, which he wrote this winter and spring.
We're talking with James Shapiro. His latest book is called The Year of Lear, which talks about Shakespeare in 1606, an age of anxiety, an age of terrorism, and an age of three of his greatest plays. So, Jim, some people, when they think of Shakespeare as a playwright, they think of him creating these great works just out of whole cloth, imagining everything. But what he did in many cases is he would go looking elsewhere for the plot of his play. And in essence, many of his plays were like reimaginings of work that other people might know. And he worked against the preconceptions of the audience.
Shakespeare was never all that interested in making up stories. He has 37 plays or so, and perhaps two of them are of his own creation. He was much more interested in seeing what others had done that had either dated poorly or were in need of what we might call a gut renovation. A play like Hamlet, 7 years earlier in his career, had been an old Elizabethan play which he upgraded in 1599. The play of King Lear is a play that he finished in 1606 that had already been a play that was staged for 15 years, a version of it by another playwright. That version had ended quite happily, with King Lear restored to his throne and reunited happily and reconciled with his younger daughter, named in that play Cordelia. So Shakespeare took this old play, and imagine you and I were going to the theater. This was one of your favorite stories, and we were going to the theater in 1606, and you persuaded me, you're going to love this play. It has the sweetest ending. And we go to see Shakespeare's version of King Lear. King Lear dies. Cordelia dies, all of Lear's daughters die, and the scene at the end of the play is apocalyptic, the stage strewn with bodies. And you're giving me a look, and I'm giving you a look, as if to say, what was Shakespeare thinking? And what Shakespeare was able to do was take familiar stories and retell them in unfamiliar ways that spoke to the moment. And the reason you had to speak to the moment was there was no radio back then. There weren't even newspapers. Theater was, other than royal proclamations and perhaps religious sermons, the only way to understand what was going on and what were the cultural preoccupations and anxieties of the day. So in retelling these stories, Shakespeare really honed in on those.
The two plays we mentioned, King Lear and Macbeth, both very dark plays. And we talked about the things that were going on at this time, you know, these public beheadings and guttings of terrorists and the tension between how people might think of the terrorists and how people might think of Parliament and the reign of these kind of political extremists. It created an era that you talk about of this age of anxiety. Like now we're not really sure how to think about our own government in some cases and prevailing threats as well. And as there were no newspapers at the time, and Shakespeare is kind of working through these anxieties of society in these plays, he's putting words into the lexicon that explain the mood of the time.
I can give you a really good example if you'd like. One of the things that happened in the immediate aftermath of the discovery of the gunpowder plot was the lodgings of everybody involved were searched. And the government officials turned up in the lodgings of one of the plotters, a how-to guide about how to lie to the authorities under oath. And it was called A Treatise of Equivocation. And equivocation had until this point really just meant, that Shakespeare uses it in Hamlet, just something that was ambiguous if you were equivocal about something or a subject was equivocal. But after 1606, it took on this really dark and pernicious meaning of you think one thing and you say another. So that if you're an official and you come to my house and you want to know if I'm harboring a Catholic priest in my house, this manual would tell me to say, Father Gerard lieth not in my house. I'm thinking that he's not telling lies in my house. You're thinking I'm saying that he doesn't reside there. And it goes on and on with the incredibly detailed instructions on how to misrepresent, how to think one thing and say another. To the Jacobean authorities, this was terrifying. It undermined all social relation, all conversation, all legal and economic agreements. If you could say one thing and think another and think it was not a lie. Shakespeare takes this and season in the trials of the gunpowder plotters, the handler of the religious advisor, so to speak, of the gunpowder plotters, a man named Father Garnett, had himself been the author of this equivocation manual. And Shakespeare takes Macbeth and makes it into a play where the word equivocation is a drumbeat and a central element of the play, where Macbeth speaks of the equivocation of the fiend that lies like truth, where the good characters, as much as the evil ones, end up in such a dark and troubling world, having to equivocate just to get by. And I think that's a mark of Shakespeare's genius, how he picks a word out that's on everybody's mind and on everybody's lips. And there are a lot of jokes in this year about the word equivocation. And he just writes a play, if you will, around that idea.
This idea that your protagonist, Macbeth, is wrestling with doing something immoral in the service of what he thinks is his destiny, this killing of King Duncan. In his speech about that, where he's kind of trying to talk himself into it and reconcile these two ideas in his head, Shakespeare's inventing language there, too.
You know, that great, great soliloquy, if it were done when 'tis done, 'twere well, it were done quickly. If the assassination could trammel up, you know, when he goes on. That word assassination to you and to me and to most of those listening who have lived through the assassination of Martin Luther King and JFK and many others in our lifetimes or in recent memory, we know that word, but that's the first time anyone, any poet, playwright, storyteller, had used that word equivocation in print. Shakespeare made up words, and this is a big word, and this is a word that lands in Macbeth. And as you say, this is a play about a man struggling about not only doing something morally awful, but about killing a Scottish king, King Duncan. And, of course, the gunpowder plotters were intent on killing a different Scottish king, King James VI of Scotland, who was now King James I of England.
We're talking with James Shapiro. His new book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. One of the things that we have seen, as you say, is Shakespeare pulling from very familiar themes of the time, terrorism, paranoia, ambivalence, equivocation. One thing that, again, modern viewers of the plays, readers of the plays might not realize is something that Shakespeare pulls into these plays that was contemporary, isn't contemporary now, and that is the supernatural. And throughout history, you know, we see a recurrence of people's interest in the supernatural in times of stress, in times of tumult, in times of paranoia. And we've got ghosts and witches and prophecies and everything in these plays. Was Shakespeare writing to an audience, maybe even a royal audience, that thought, hey, you know, demon possession is real, and so this is going to give credibility to these plays?
I think this was a society in which everybody either half believed or fully believed in supernatural issues. And I suspect if you asked most Americans, we would agree to some extent in the supernatural. There are very few of us who are so radically skeptical as to deny its forces entirely. King James himself had written a book on demonology. He had persecuted witches, or those women he claimed to be witches, when he was king of Scotland. And 1606 was a year in which the anxieties rose to the level of belief in supernatural forces. Either you think that evil deeds begin within the human heart, or you think they come from outside of that individual. And if they come from the outside, then they're the work of the devil operating through witches or other kinds of demonic forces. And this is central to not just Macbeth, but even to the character of Edgar in King Lear, who assumes the role of a possessed madman in that play. So Shakespeare is writing for an audience that believes in this, and when you have the witches and Hecate in Macbeth, he's writing something that's perhaps more real then than it is now, but it's right at the heart of these central questions of where does evil come from?
You mentioned that Shakespeare was the king's man, or one of the king's men at the time, and he was actually a groom of the chamber. What does that mean?
That means he was a minor court official. So that, for example, I mean, when King James makes Shakespeare and his fellow players king's men, he has them issued 4.5 yards of red cloth to be made up in livery, basically a doorman outfit, so that when King James needed them for official ceremonies to make it look like the court was more glamorous, perhaps, than it was, Shakespeare had to show up in the summer of 1604 when King James is negotiating a peace treaty with Spain. Shakespeare and his fellow players had to leave the Globe Theater and show up at court 18 days in a row for pennies, really, and walk around in the livery entertaining the Spanish embassy. So when I said earlier, it's a mixed blessing being a king's man. Sure, you like the royal patronage, but it's not so great when you have to perform for the king in this way. On the other hand, it gave Shakespeare incredible access to the workings of power. It's like one of us hanging out in the White House for 18 days. You see things and you see how the levers of politics work up close and personal. And of course, Shakespeare wrote with incredible insight into how kings and aristocrats behave because he had access to that.
So you have King James with the ability to snap his fingers and then Shakespeare has to show up dressed in his special outfit to fill out the crowd. At the same time, maybe not in 1606, but around this same era, King James is commissioning the King James Bible. So there's been so much speculation. Yeah. Did Shakespeare contribute to writing the King James Bible?
You know, that's a really good question. Even as plays like Lear, Macbeth, and Antony and Cleopatra are being written and staged at the Globe by Shakespeare and his fellow players, there are a group of a score or so translators at this very moment creating the King James Bible. And it's a thrilling, thrilling idea. I would say that, we know who were the people who were involved in writing the King James Bible, but I would put it indirectly. They're both part of a great, rich moment in the English language. And these are people who are going to see Shakespeare's plays or reading them in early printed quartos. So it's only indirectly that Shakespeare and what he does to the language and what his fellow playwrights and poets are doing to the language that makes its way into the King James Bible. But there are reasons why we hear the sonority and the sounds of that Bible when we hear Shakespeare. And when we read the Bible, we feel the Shakespearean elements of it. They're products of the same moment, and they did bleed into each other.
And those authors are probably going to see Shakespeare's plays.
Absolutely, absolutely. Not only in London, but when Shakespeare's company visited Oxford and Cambridge, where many of these translators were working.
So you look at this point, and the King James Bible is going to transform the literary experience of the English-speaking word. And Shakespeare is really writing these plays on the cusp of a major change in the literary and emotional lives of people.
I couldn't agree more. And yet the paradox is we today are in love with the Tudors, with Queen Elizabeth and Henry VIII, and there are endless movies and TV programs about them. But there's nothing on this extraordinary Jacobean moment when the King James Bible and Shakespeare's plays, two of the great cultural products of English culture and of the language, are produced. So one of the things that I was trying to do in writing this book was draw attention to a moment that's been unfortunately overlooked by historians and cultural historians.
One final thing, James. Next year marks the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, and I know you'll be involved with some of the celebrations. What can we be looking for in 2016 when it comes to Shakespeare?
It's going to be an extraordinary year, and scholars and institutions have been planning for this for many years. The most exciting thing is that the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., which owns 82 first folios of Shakespeare's complete works, or 36 plays that he wrote, will be sending a copy of the folio to every state in the United States, and there will be for 1 month during this year a Shakespeare festival in each state, and I think that's extraordinary and really exciting, and I'll try to visit as many of those states as I can.
Well, hopefully we'll see you here.
I look forward to that.
James Shapiro has been joining us this hour. His latest book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. James, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's great talking with you.